everybody, and welcome back to another beautiful Thursday morning. I'm so happy to be back with all of you. We've had a couple weeks of playing repeats since PRN was working out their new location, and I'm really so thrilled to be back here with all of you. I have missed being on the show. So I have a great show today. My guest is going to be Joe Churchy. He is the face of the craft beer movement here on Long Island. He works for a company called Starfish Junction, and I'll be inviting him on in a little while. But first, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the TEDx Manhattan that I went to this past weekend, which was absolutely great. And also talk to you about some things going on in and around the news. So let's get started. First, on my website, and if you get my newsletters, you will notice that I sent out a bunch of things to take action for. You know, right now they're trying to pass through some genetically modified trees that we don't want to let happen. And there's a petition for you to sign for that. Also, we want to keep up the pressure to support GMO labeling. And there's a petition for that. And then we also want to tell our policymakers that we want to limit sugar in and added sugar into our foods. I mean, they put that into everything these days, and we really, really need to keep that out of our drinks and help our kids get a little healthier. So please take a look at my website at ieatgreen.com and sign on to some of these petitions. They're really, really important. TEDx this past weekend was just phenomenal. There was a whole lineup of speakers from Joel Berg, who was talking about the New York Coalition Against Hunger and the anti-hunger movement and what's going on in the city around that. We heard from Dana Cowan from the Food and Wine editor. Danny Meyer was there talking about how there's an emergence right now of fine dining with casual dining and how the quality of the fine dining is still being sought after, but in a more casual environment. And that's still going on. So who else was there? It was just great. We heard from Stephanie Sachs, who was a past guest on my show. She's a culinary nutritionist and author of What the Fork Are You Eating? Danielle Nuremberg from Food Tank was there. And at the very end, there was a great, great performance of a poem by Nikiko Masumoto. She really brought down the house. Her poem was so beautifully worded, and she brought so much passion to the dictation. It was just so moving. And all of these TEDx talks will be back online. They had to take them down while they're making the official reel, but they will all be back up online, and you'll be able to hear them live. And I really, really recommend everybody doing that. It was just really wonderful. Another standout speaker was Michelle Merkel. She works for Food and Water Watch now in their legal arm, the Food and Water Justice. But prior to that, she worked for the EPA, and she was involved in a lot of the lawsuits that that farmers were bringing against agribusiness and factory farms. And at some point during this, during the lawsuits, she was ordered by the EPA to just settle and to drop it, basically, because of pressure from corporations. And she had to do that, and it killed her, and she left the job. And now she's working for Food and Water Watch, where she can really work for the people and work for the small family farmers who are trying to do the right thing. But one of the most exciting things is really watching this movement grow, the movement of people that care about their food, care about where it's coming from, and are really putting that first. And we're we're really making a difference, and we're starting to drive the market. I mean, Danny Meyer talked about that when I was down, you know, at the Food Tank Summit last month. They were talking about that with Chipotle and Panera Bread, how, you know, they're like a fast food chain that's really demanding meats that are raised without antibiotics and hormones. And this demand is driving the market. And right now, there's not enough supply to even meet the market. So as farmers see this, they will see the path to transitioning over to raising animals in a more sustainable way, because that's what needs to happen. That's what needs to happen for the future of the planet. That's what needs to happen for everybody's health. And that's what people are demanding. And so we need to keep that pressure up. And what I want to encourage all of you out there to do is, whenever you go to a restaurant, anytime, even if, of course, it's not going to make the decision whether you're going to stay in the restaurant or not. This is purely a way of taking some action. Is whenever you are at a restaurant, ask what meat or fish they are serving that is wild, sustainably raised, and make your decision on what you're going to order based on that. And if they don't have anything that is wild or sustainably raised, okay, well, then you make the best choice you can. But they need to know that their customers are looking for this, because as we look for it and we demand it, they will start carrying it. And that's what's really exciting. Right now I'm involved in putting together the Long Island Food Conference with the North Shore Land Alliance and the Long Island Food Coalition and Slow Food North Shore and many other players. And we're putting together this food conference that's going to be really exciting. But one of the panels is on procurement. How do you find the quality ingredients that you're looking for? And we're also looking at that as far as school food goes, institutional food. There used to be a law that, you know, school food always had to take the lowest bid. But now when it comes to local food, they are allowed to make a decision based on supporting a local farmer. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the cheapest bid out there anymore. So that's really an exciting thing. Another thing that I wrote about this week was these smart meters that are being spread out into people's homes through National Grid and PSEG. And these smart meters is a relatively new technology, and it's really questionable as to its safety. And before you go ahead and allow the utility company permission to put one of these smart meters into your home, I suggest we all do our homework. They're saying that, you know, children, pregnant women, and people with pacemakers are particularly vulnerable to the impacts of this exposure of RF radiation. But it's just more radiation. We're all getting so much already. Do we really want something emitting constant radiation in our home? And I don't think so. So look into that before you just open your doors to this new technology. And then I also want to just say that, you know, this past Sunday was International Women's Day, and this is all, you know, Women's History Month. And last night I went to see this wonderful film called Arise. It was being put on by the Green Belt Conservatory, which is a incredible organization out of Staten Island that I didn't know about. I also didn't know that Staten Island has, you know, dense woods and and hikes and, you know, big or small mountains right there on Staten Island, where you can really go out on hikes and night hikes. And it was just amazing to learn about the preservation of this green space that they have on Staten Island. But in the film were women from all across the world who are really working together and making change. There was a cooperative in Kenya that they talked about. You know, in so many developing countries, it is the women that are really taking up the responsibility of getting food on the table. And whether that means growing food, helping to educate their children, they are the ones holding down the forts. And women working together and taking out microloans and really making industry happen and create bringing money into their towns. It's really remarkable. There was a wonderful woman, Palestinian woman, in the film who was creating peace with Israeli women, and they were coming together in circles and working on peace issues. And it was just, you know, the fundamentals of what's important to all of us in life are the same across all kinds of barriers. And when you don't have those barriers and you come together in a circle, it's just amazing what can happen. Majora Carter was in the film talking about the South Bronx and greening that up. It was just a really, really powerful film. If you have a chance to see the film Arise, I would really highly, highly recommend it. And the last thing I wrote about was, again, the issue with vaccines. I know that, you know, it's still being talked about even, you know, after this supposed epidemic of measles is coming back. But there's a real question as to whether the spread of measles was happening from unvaccinated people or whether it was happening from vaccinated people. Turns out for up to a month after someone is vaccinated with a live vaccine, they can still be spreading the disease. And that's not something that we're told about. So that's something to look into. I have a great article on my website that you can link to. And then another interesting article that was talked about on NPR last week was this new bacterium called C. diff. And it's, you know, it is a result of everybody taking so many antibiotics. And this is one of those super bugs that seems to not be able to be killed. But it was really, really interesting article. So check out my website at iegreen.com for some of these great, great articles. Many things are going on in and around the area that I want to share with you. This weekend, there's actually an organization on Long Island that I only recently found out about called Long Island Jobs with Justice. Great organization. And they are having their conference March 13th, and it's called Working But Still Poor Conference. And it's going to be at Truro Law Center in Central Islip. It is on March 13th, all day from 8:30 to 2:30. It's $30, includes lunch. You can go to the Long Island Jobs with Justice website to find out more about that. The New York City Vegetarian Food Festival is coming up this weekend, March 14th and 15th at the Metropolitan Pavilion. Also this weekend and the following weekend, March 14th and 21st, there's a seed workshop. It's called Seeds, What Every Community Gardener Wants to Know. That's taking place out at Stony Brook University Wang Center. It's free. It's from 8 to 3. I know the people running it, Heather Forrest and Larry Foglia, are the owners of Fox Hollow Farm. They ran a CSA for many years. They're great, and I highly recommend it. It would be a great jump on your spring gardening. Just Food Conference is coming up March 15th, all day long at the Teachers College. Check out Just Food Conference on their website. The Spring Craft Festival is coming up. That's March 21st, and we'll talk more about that with my guest today, since he is one of the organizers, or his company is the organizer behind the Spring Craft Beer Festival, which is at Nassau Coliseum on March 21st. At Farmingdale State College, the Horticulture Department is sponsoring this other all-day workshop called Flower Power: Growing and Designing with Flowers for All Seasons. That is all day from 9 to 5 on March 25th. March 28th, this is really a great, great workshop that I wanted to share with everyone out there. The Waldorf School, which, as many of you know, is very dear to my heart. I am a trained Waldorf teacher, and I ran the cafeteria at the Waldorf School in Garden City for many years. March 28th, they are having a speaker, David Sobel, there as the keynote for a full day workshop called Children and Nature, Making Connections for the Future. And I think we've all heard about nature deprivation and the problem that kids are having today in playing. I mean, sometimes you can put kids outside, they don't even know what to do anymore. They're so connected to electronics and to tablets and you know, square boxes, and that when you put them out in the nature, they don't even know what to do. So it's really becoming a problem, and it will affect the future of our children. And so we need to help make these connections again with nature. So this is a full day conference from 8:30 to 5. Check out the Winkler Center for Adult Learning. It is at the Waldorf School, but the Winkler Center for Adult Learning is bringing this full day workshop. It's going to be great. March 29th, I am one of the organizers with Slow Food North Shore for the Long Island Food and Film Feast. And this was our second time doing this. We did it last year, and it was such a success. We're showing a whole bunch, actually I think 9 short documentaries, and each of them will be paired with food and a speaker. So it's a whole evening event starting at 6:30 at the Cinema Arts Center. You can buy tickets online at thecinemaartscenter.org, or there's a link on my website as well. But we have some great, great films for you there, as well as some great food. We have a film on the Brooklyn Brewery, on fermentation. We'll be serving some beer and some kombucha to go along with those films. We have a movie on dumpster diving, and we will be recovering food for the entree for that dish. We also have some social enterprises that we will be highlighting: DC Central Kitchen in Washington, and the Grow to Give Gardens here on Long Island, of how some organizations are really creating models that are making big impacts into our communities. So it's a great event, the Long Island Food and Film Festival. It was sold out last year, so please buy tickets ahead of time. Do not wait. April 12th is the Josh Levine Memorial Cocktail Party out in Sag Harbor, and you can find out more about that on the Slow Food East End website. April 22nd is Earth Day. Lots of events going on, lots of places. Check out earthday.org online and find out about an event close to you. Lots of schools during this week are having cooking demos and having speakers. So hopefully, you know, your kids will be coming home talking about Earth Day as well. Lots of dates to save. The biggest one I want to tell you about is April 25th for the Long Island Food Conference. That is an all-day event, really, really great. Our keynote speaker is Stephen Ritz from the Bronx Green Machine. He actually was the award recipient this year at TEDx Manhattan. You got to listen to his TEDx talk. It's just great. He is so full of passion. He is so excited up there on the stage, and he is going to do a great, great talk for us at the Long Island Food Conference, along with all day long different workshops, speakers. I'll be doing a cooking demo. I'm putting together a panel of chefs to talk about, again, how chefs are driving and helping to educate the public and driving the food market. So all great things. So I hope you all can make it and save the date, April 25th. So now I'd like to share a recipe with you. This is a miso vegetable soup with ramen noodles. And for the first time, I made this sesame nori crunch that was just so good. It really really was the finishing touch that I think makes this miso soup a standout. So you need 12 cups of water, 4 cloves of garlic, 3 1-inch pieces of ginger peeled, 1 organic onion, 3 organic carrots, 2 organic celery stalks, a half a head of organic cauliflower cut into florets, 3 turnips chopped, 1 bunch of kale chopped, a 10-ounce package of organic tofu, firm or soft would work, cut into small cubes, a half a cup of red miso, 1 8 to 10-ounce package of ramen noodles, depending on your package, different sizes, and cook that separately al dente. And you just add a little bit at a time to each bowl of soup. That way, if you have leftover soup, you can store the soup and the noodles separately, and the noodles don't turn into mush. Then you want I had unprocessed nori to make my nori crunch. Regular nori would work too if you don't have the unprocessed kind. But I bought this unprocessed kind for the first time at the farmer's market last year, and it was great using it in this way. And I mixed that with 3 tablespoons of sesame seeds. So in a large pot, I sauteed my onions, carrots, and celery in olive oil for about 5 minutes. Then I added the cauliflower, the turnips, the garlic, and ginger, and I continued cooking for about 5 more minutes. Then I added the water to the pot and brought that to a boil. And then I reduced the heat and added the tofu and the kale and let that simmer for about 20 minutes. Then I took out a cup of the hot broth, and in a separate bowl, I mixed that with the miso. One thing when you're making miso soup that you want to know is you don't want to let the miso boil. That destroys a lot of the micronutrients and nutritional value of the miso. So once you mix that miso up with the cup of water, then you can add that back into the soup pot. And then you can just taste it. If you want to add a little more miso, if you want it a little stronger, a little saltier, you can do that. And then in a heavy cast iron pan, separately, I toasted the nori for about a minute and added the sesame seeds. And then I just drizzled a little bit dark sesame oil over the nori and sesame seeds, just to give it a little bit more flavor until it was golden brown. That was only about a minute. It cooks very fast. Then I ran the noodles under warm water before adding them to the individual bowls just to get them hot, and then put the broth and the noodles right on top, and that's it. And then garnish it with the sesame nori crunch, and it was just delicious. This recipe also will be posted on my website as well as on the Progressive Radio Network website. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Joe Churchy. He is manager and sales marketing manager for Starfish Junction, which is a production company on Long Island, and they have been responsible for running the beer festivals that so many of us have been able to enjoy. Joe, are you with me?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning, and welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Great. So can you share with us first how you got interested in the craft beer movement?
Well, it started for me back probably, when I was in college, early 2000s. I was tired of the normal, rigmarole of like the Bud Lights, all the domestics. And I started getting a little curious and trying, an occasional Magic Hat here, or Sierra Nevada, Pale Ale there. And I realized that there's a lot more to beer than what they were showing me. So I started really, doing my research and getting involved and trying to find out as much as I can about this, this craft beer, as they're calling it. Or at that time, it was still microbrews. And once I realized, I realized that I'm a fan of hops. I like, they're wheat beers, Belgian beers, different styles. Like it's so much more than what they were just letting us, what the major brands were letting us see. And, and being in college, it was always tough because, of course it's always more expensive, but, I found it was definitely quality over quantity for me. So I prefer the quality product, instead of buying a 6-pack for the same price my friends were getting 18 packs for, but, I was enjoying it more. So.
Yeah, definitely. Well, can you, elaborate a little bit more on some of the different types of beers, like you know, there's the Indian Pale Ale versus an ale or a lager. What makes one an Indian Pale Ale versus a lager, let's say, or which ones have more hops and which ones have more whatever?
Well, the India, I'll start off with the India Pale Ale, the IPA. That was actually, the way they got the name for it was, when they were fighting, when the Brits were fighting, they had to ship all their beer around Africa. And by the time it made the trip around to India, it would spoil. So they realized that if you over hop it, it preserves the beer a little better, and it makes it a little more bitter. But it would be able to save, it would be able to make the trip, and not spoil. So that's where the name India Pale Ale came from.
So that's a little hoppier than some of the others.
Those are prototypically your hoppiest beers. They have very high IBUs, which are international bitterness units. Whereas like a wheat beer or a lager might have something lower. A typical IPA ranges anywhere from 75 IBUs, and you can have some some lagers that or wheats that are, you know, 5. So it really depends on what you like. I mean, there is something out there for everyone. I know people that say they don't like beer or they don't like dark beers because, you know, when you think of stout, you think Guinness. But there are, you know, different types of stouts. There are breakfast stouts. There are oatmeal stouts. There are, chili stouts. So it really is a wide array, and there really is something for everyone out there now, which is nice.
Uh-huh. You know, very often you see seasonal beer too, like fall beer will have pumpkin in it. Do they actually put pumpkin in the beer?
Some do. Some breweries actually used real, ground up pumpkins to give it the flavor. A lot of other ones are, use the pumpkin spices, the nutmegs, the cinnamons, the allspice. And the way the season breaks down is like in the spring, it's always lighter beers. In the summer, it's usually nice lagers that you can drink while you're at the beach or on a boat or enjoying the outdoors. Falls are always going to be spiced. The pumpkins over the past 5 years have blown up. I remember going back, it was only one or two pumpkins, and now it seems that everyone's doing a pumpkin or
right.
multiple pumpkins. So that's, I mean, and people like it. With the distributors and the breweries I talk to, pumpkins, they can't even keep them on the shelves. And you'll find that they're coming out earlier and earlier and earlier. Now we have, pumpkins hitting in August. When pumpkins are the last thing on people's minds, they still want to enjoy the summer, but their pumpkins are already coming out because, people, if it's out there, people will buy them.
Uh-huh.
So.
And what about the quality of ingredients that goes into the craft beer? Is it a higher quality than commercial beer?
It's different quality. Not necessarily bad quality. It's just you're getting, with the ingredients that some of these craft breweries are using to purchase them on such a large scale that they would have to use them for, it kind of, they kind of use alternatives. Nothing bad. I mean, listen, there are great beers out there, and there are, the domestics. I mean, you could get a can of Budweiser in New York, California, wherever, and it's going to taste the same product. And that's the one thing the big breweries do have is the ability to,
consistency,
exactly. Produce the right. same thing all the time. With the smaller breweries, now they're, a lot of them are going local, sticking with local resourced, hops and greens and, stuff, the adjuncts, the pumpkins, the raspberries, the blueberries, the potatoes in some of them.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them are using locally sourced products. And that's the whole thing about, with craft beer, it's handcrafted. It's supporting your local community. It's being your local, your local favorite. I mean, back, at the turn of the century, there was, almost every town had their own little brewery in some way, shape, or form. And now, after Prohibition, that kind of went away, and now we're seeing another, a resurgence of that. Riverhead alone has 3 breweries in it.
In Riverhead, right? In
Riverhead alone, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And there are more coming.
Really? So, now, do you see do communities support these upstart breweries? Like, do they welcome a brewery coming into a community as a new revenue of resources, or do they feel like it's going to bring a bad crowd of drinkers into the community? How do most communities open their doors to a new craft beer?
A lot of communities are very accepting to it. They open them with open arms because it is a locally produced item that they can really get behind. And you look at what certain, breweries have done to areas like, now Patchogue is going through a whole revitalization with, Blue Point and the Brick House Brewery and stuff who went in there, put their feet in the ground, and now, the whole town is actually building up, around them. So a lot of them, and this is throughout the country, a lot of them are supporting their local people. And you know, it's almost like, you know, too many shovels in the sandbox, but you know, just build a bigger sandbox. And that's what everyone's doing. You know, everyone's accepting of one another and supporting one another, and really getting behind that. You know, we're local. We're the local guys. And it's not necessarily, it's not a lot of these craft beers. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, you know, when I, you know, in college, I didn't want to, you know, if I was going out, you know, the majority of my friends are going out to the bars and you know, just whooping it up. And, you know, these breweries aren't like that. I mean, if you go to any of the tasting rooms that any of these breweries have, it's more, you know, it's a calmer crowd. It's not the people going out there to get, you know, drunk. Exactly. They appreciate the beer. They support the beer. They embrace it. Basically, they want to know about it. They want to know what goes into it. They want to know what kind of hops are used, or what, you know, what the grains were. You know, so people are looking
it's
for.
It's kind of like it's kind of like birthing a whole connoisseur of beers.
Exactly.
Right.
Because, you know, for so long, everyone was just told, all right, you have the lager, you know, the German-style lager, Pilsner, then you have the light lager, Pilsner, and that was it. And then, you know, you had breweries like Sam Adams and Sierra Nevada and you know, I mean, that put their feet, you know, laid the groundwork for this stuff, and now they're just, you know, they're seeing it prosper. And they're
would you consider like a Sam Adams and a Sierra Nevada still a craft brewery?
Absolutely. They produce some great products, and according to the, you know, the Brewers Alliance, you have to, I believe it's 6 million barrels. If you produce more than 6 million barrels, you're no longer considered a craft brewery. But you know, it's the type of thing with like Sam Adams, they're in the forefront. They're still coming out. I mean, they're just releasing their Rebel IPA and their Rebel Rouser and the Rebel Rider and all these different types of variations on one of their now flagship beers. And it's people, you know, because there are so many small ones and the other ones have been around for so long, people kind of look at them like, oh, they've been around forever. They don't, you know, they can't do anything. I mean, Sierra Nevada last year took a project on where it was, they called it Beer Camp, where basically they went through and invited every craft brewery in the country to participate in these 7 different festivals that were going from ranging from California to Maine. And they did collaboration beers with 12 different well-known breweries throughout the country. And they're still in the forefront. They're the ones that are setting the standard for a lot of these smaller guys.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, and they're, you know, and with, like, say, Sierra Nevada, they're, I believe it's either 100% or 90% all natural energy between wind turbines and solar panels and stuff like
cool.
that.
So, uh-huh.
So a lot of them, you know, they're setting the you know, setting the tone for the rest of the industry.
Right.
But yeah, no, those I would definitely still consider those guys craft.
You would. Okay, good. Well, I want to take a couple minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about, you know, how does the beer change, or what happens when the beer is acquired by one of the bigger companies? Because I know, you know, as far as the beer market goes, the craft beer movement is, or the craft beers are the ones that are exploding, and the old timers are kind of stagnant in their growth. And so they're trying to buy up a lot of these smaller guys, and I know they have bought up some, and I'm just curious as to what happens when that happens. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. The discussion is going to get really interesting when we get back. So just hang with us just a couple more minutes. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani on the Progressive Radio Network at IE Green. And I'm here with Joe Churchy from Starfish Junction, and we're talking about the craft beer movement. And when we led off, we were just talking about how some of the small craft breweries – who are getting bigger are actually being bought out by some of the bigger, larger beer companies. And Joe, are you with me?
I am.
Can you share with us what happens when a small brewery is bought up by a big beer company? And my curiosity, you know, I'm in the food area most of the time, and I know when a lot of the small health food companies are bought up by big companies, the big companies get in there and start trying to change the rules a little bit and start putting in, you know, artificial flavors and changing things up a little bit. So it's no longer really the natural food company I used to love. Can you share with us how it is when a large beer company like an Anheuser-Busch, buys up a small beer company?
Well, yeah, I mean, over the past, you know, this has been a very heated topic of debate over, you know, the past, you know, couple of months. You know, seeing that one of Long Island's own was picked up by Anheuser-Busch and InBev.
Which one?
Blue Point Brewing Company out in Patchogue. They were, you know, I'd probably say the second oldest brewery on the island. You know, they started that back in 98. And, you know, what the benefits to, you know, to them, you know, being purchased is, you know, they go from brewing, I don't know if you've ever been to the brewery, but they went from the small little system to now brewing on some of the best equipment in the world, being Anheuser-Busch's. When it comes to the quality, they brought the brewers from Blue Point out to their plants, and they went through and basically showed them, you know, this is the way that we brew, the Blue Point guys. And this is, you know, they don't change any of the recipes. Basically, everything's going to stay the same. You know, and what now they have the flexibility to do stuff on a larger scale that they haven't been able to do before. They've been known for their Cask Ale Festival. This is going to be the 11th year coming up, and now they're actually going to be doing a cask program where they're going out to bars and bringing the casks to different locations, and they're going to have special stuff in those casks. That are, you know, that otherwise they wouldn't have been able to do. You know, they're going to be able to expand their facilities in Patchogue, which in turn helps the community, helps build up the community, more jobs, more people coming into the town. So, it seems that the trend, you know, between either Anheuser-Busch or SAB Miller coming and buying breweries to add into their portfolio, it seems common that a lot of them, like in the past, you know, in the past, the whole idea was they were going to buy these companies up and just bury them because we don't want the competition. These are the big boys. We're going to flex our muscles. But now it's almost like they're adopting these brands and really trying to, you know, do right by them, getting them expanded distribution, getting them national exposure, and giving them the opportunity to do stuff that they wouldn't normally do. I mean, you know, people always ask, oh, are they still craft? You know, how do you look at them? And I will put any person that says anything that is owned by AB is not craft, I'd sit them down with Goose Island Bourbon County Stout or one of the the vintage line that Goose Island does and in turn ask them, tell me that's not craft. You know, now with the financial resources, they're able to experiment, they're able to try new things, and that's, unfortunately, people look at it the way, they sold out. No, I don't think they sold out. I definitely think that they did right by what their company, you know, does. And it's you know, a company like Blue Point's been around since, like, 98. And, they have their footprint on Long Island. And I think, if anything, that brings more exposure to Long Island and the Long Island craft beer scene. So I think it really helps everyone, you know, in the mix, whether it's, you know, whether it's Blue Point, it's one of the smaller guys, just starting up. So,
When some of these small craft breweries, you know, one of the things with larger corporations is also how they treat their employees. And, you know, there's a whole line, you know, if I'm comparing it to the natural food market, you know, and seeing that trend, you know, I think it changes all the way down where, you know, it used to be where the workers were a part of the company and now they're working for a big corporation, you know, and it's, you know, it changes the vibe.
It changes, you know? It changes the vibe. I, you know, I've seen it and I've seen stuff like that happen where a new management team or a new ownership comes in and it kind of just, you know, certain things are built off of their reputation and the personal connection that people have
right.
to them.
Right.
And then once something like this comes in, you know,
it has to change.
It has to change, but not necessarily for the bad.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, you look at, I mean, you know, we keep using them as an example, but for Blue Point Brewing Company, they expanded their tasting room. They're able to get more people in there. So on a Saturday night, that you know, when you used to go in and it used to be packed and you couldn't get in, you know, now there's more room. Now, you know, those people that are regulars that are staying with them, that are, you know, their hometown beer, they're just going to be more in a more comfortable setting.
Now that they're, you know, they're bigger, when they need to make pumpkin beer and they're no longer making pumpkin on a small scale, they need to make millions of barrels of pumpkin. Do they use artificial pumpkin flavoring?
I believe everything that they've done at the brewery is going to stay consistent. So if they have used, you know, their pureed pumpkin, then they're still going to be doing that. They're not going to cut corners to, you know, because this product is so well established, they don't want to tinker it, because believe it or not, people will know if they're drinking the same beer, but one's made at the brewery and one's brewed up in you know, upstate New York. You know, you can tell the difference, you know. And everyone says, oh, you know, you really can't create it, but with the way they could test the water, test the pH in the water, and recreate Long Island water, now it's on a larger scale, they're not going to be really cutting any corners, to my knowledge. You know, from what I've been told, is all systems go status quo. With what they have been doing in the past.
And does the craft beer movement? You know, I know you mentioned, you know, certain standards to qualify for a craft beer movement. With, for instance, how much beer you make. Are there also standards with quality of ingredients, or not really?
I mean, I'll put it this way. The people that don't use the better ingredients, you can tell. The brewers that, you know, have cut corners, you can definitely tell, because their product is not up to the standards that do, you know, of the guys that do use the highest level of ingredients. You know, a lot of them do use the same sources for their barley, for their hops and stuff like that. So, I mean, it is pretty consistent across the board. And I think really to get a brewery license and stuff like that, you do have to meet certain requirements on where you're getting your products from and stuff like that.
Because I think a lot of the local breweries also are trying to buy, like you said before, local ingredients. And I know there's been I've heard talk as a gardener of growing hops, for instance, because there's a shortage of hops, and you know, people are having a hard time getting enough, especially organic hops, hops that is grown without any type of spray and things like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're out in like Riverhead and you're driving down, you know, either 25 or you know, some of those main roads out there, and you're looking, you see these things growing straight up in the air, like 18 foot tall. That's hops.
Right.
The east end of Long Island, you know, New York used to be the largest hop producing state in the country. And then, you know, they you know, the vineyards really took over, and then other cash crops moved in, and you know, there really wasn't a high demand for the hops. But now, you know, come 2015, I believe there's five or six different hop farms popping out up on the east end that over the past 3 years, they've really been growing their crop, and you know, now they're really going to be starting to gain the yield that they need for, you know, commercial production.
Right, right. Because the first time I saw it growing was up at Stone Barns in Tarrytown. I was at the farm, and I was like, "What is this growing up? These, you know, they you hang from a tall pole. You hang all these strings down, and the hops kind of like grab on and grow straight up. You know, like you said, 20 feet up."
Yeah, I mean, it's wild. And I mean, you know, you look at a lot of like the home brewers and you know, I mean, I've taken on, you know, two plants myself that I'm trying to, you know, get up and going, you know, once the snow leaves and the weather gets nicer, they're going to come out of, you know, hibernation. But, you know, a lot of these guys are, you know, they're small little projects, and it definitely makes them, you know, get more connected with the beer. You know, seeing one of the key ingredients of it go from a little sprout to this, you know, to these rising vines, it's amazing.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing. And then, of course, they're going to turn around and, you know, take a homebrew and make a homebrew with it. And you know, and then they have even more. Not only did I make the beer itself, but I had firsthand experience in making the hops that are going into it. So it really gives everyone like a real personal connection with it.
Uh-huh. Now, you've been you know, in this business for almost 10 years, how have you seen it change? How have you seen the retailers changing? You know, we talked about the explosion of the breweries coming into towns, but what about the regular bars? Do you see them changing to have more beer on tap now? And, you know, how is the beer movement driving, you know, the regular bar industry?
Yeah, it's funny. Years ago, it used to be, you know, you go into all these bars and you look on tap, and the things that you see are all the major domestics, you know, with you know, maybe a Sam Adams thrown in. But you'd see the Bud, Miller, Coors, you know, those guys on draft. And then maybe about 6 years ago, you really started seeing, you know, some of the crafts really take over and slip one or two in here. And now they went from having a 6-line system to having a 20-line system that only carries craft. You know, you look at some of these bars that have, you know, 52 taps. It's all craft. You know, years ago, that wouldn't have sustained because people weren't really educated. And I think as people's palates are evolving with between all the artisan breads, cheeses, you know, organic or organic products, you know, all these, they're really caring about what they put in their body. And I think there's just an extension. So now you'll have bars and restaurants that are, you know, doing beer dinners where they pair some of these breweries' beers with some of their their best dishes.
Oh,
and really? Uh-huh. And it really, you know, why does this pair well with that? Or, you know, this feeds off of this because. So, I mean, it's definitely grown. You used to go into the beer distributors, and it used to have maybe one small wire rack of some craft beers that were, you know, just thrown on there. And now it's really starting to dominate the landscape of these home distributors.
Uh-huh.
Because we have breweries popping up, and we're getting stuff from around the country that is you know, award-winning and really starting to, you know, like I said, get a bigger sandbox and
right.
Really, you know, really start to, you know, compare and contrast and see what different, you know, it's almost down to like now people can get down to specific hop styles. And they like beers with that specific hop style best, whether it be the Cascade.
Yeah, like I said, you know, there's a real connoisseur palate being developed now, and you can really see it. It's changed so much. But before we run out of time, I want to talk about this craft beer festival you have coming up. Can you share with us some information about that?
Sure. On March 21st, we're going to be holding the 9th Annual Spring Craft Beer Festival at the Nassau Coliseum in Uniondale. This is, you know, with all intents and, you know, all intents and purposes being the last one at the current configuration of the Coliseum before they start remodeling it. But yeah, I mean, the Spring Festival has grown from, you know, the first year, 500 people, and nothing really going on, to, you know, this year there's, you know, we're expecting another sellout. We're going to have close to, 200 different beers from over 80 different breweries, local and international, local, national, and international brands. And it's definitely, expanded. I mean, I remember attending the first one as an attendee, and I was like, this is great. And there was, it was funny what the definition of craft was, or what the way people looked at craft was. It was basically anything that wasn't the big guys. So it was a lot of international brands and stuff like that. And now it's, strictly craft. And I mean, we have over 24 breweries on Long Island alone. And seeing that we have three homebrew clubs on Long Island.
Can I ask, are any of the breweries on Long Island organic?
I know a lot of them are working towards it. I don't know if they're fully organic. It's tough because of certain ingredients are only available, non-organic. And if they want to go organic, it's anywhere from 2 to 4 times the the regular price. So I know a lot of them want to. It's just once they need to really just get some more capital, I guess, to make it organic. But yeah, I mean, we have everyone from the Shark coming in, to the Long Island Bagpipers open up the second session by doing a nice a nice entrance through the hall of attendees. And I mean, it's a good experience for anyone who's looking to try craft beer that doesn't want to spend the $30 on a case of beer that you're not sure if you're going to like it. So it's a great way to come in and try all these different offerings from these great breweries that
But you said there's two sessions, or I heard
two sessions, correct.
Right? One in the afternoon, or
yeah, there's a 12:30 to 4, and then a 5:30 to 9.
Uh-huh.
And the 12:30 to 4 session's almost like it's almost become like more of the connoisseur session, where people really want to come in and they really want to learn about the beers, and they're going to ask you questions that no one will ever ask you, or you haven't been asked, yet. Uh-huh. And it's more of like a learning session. People come in and really, ask the questions that they want to know. And
okay. So where do people get tickets? Because we are just about out of time.
Okay. You can get tickets on the website, springcraftbeerfestival.com, or at the Nassau Coliseum box office. Tickets are moving fast, especially with it being next weekend. So if you haven't gotten your tickets already, go out and get them. We plan to rock the barn one more time and really make this a memorable festival.
Right. Well, Joe, thanks so much for coming on board. The timing was just perfect with this festival coming up. And, I live with a beer connoisseur, so it's, we're always having new beers in this house. And nice. It's really, it's a wonderful thing. So thank you for bringing the beer movement helping spread it here on Long Island. And thank you, everyone out there, for joining us. You've been
listening
to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Be back with you next week. Bye for now.